look at session 10. It's a 12-part series on the Song of Solomon. And for those of you that are new with the book of Song of Solomon, you're here the first time. It's an 8-chapter love song that can be interpreted first in the natural way. It shows the beauty of married love. It magnifies the beauty of married love. It's a natural love song, 8 chapters. But also you can interpret it spiritually, magnifying the love of Jesus and the way that he loves his people. And it's the spiritual application that we are approaching this study in, although the other one, the natural application and the more literal direct one, is a very, very important interpretation of this book as well. And it's an 8-chapter love song, and there's a progression going on. I call it the progression of holy passion. That in the first chapter, she's sincere and immature, and in the second chapter, she's tested and tried. The third chapter, she learned some new things. In the fourth chapter, each chapter, she matures. There's a progression that's going on. And in our last session, in session 9, we're on session 10 right now, we looked at chapter 5. And I'm going to review it very, very briefly, because chapter 6, the drama of what happens is chapter 6 is so linked to what happened, the testing of chapter 5. So though we looked at this in our last session, I'm going to take a minute to review chapter 5, just ever so quickly. Then we're going to go on and look at the Lord's response to her. Because chapter 5 was the testing she went through, and chapter 6 was the Lord's response to her testing. Now we all go through testings, and I can't think of anything more important than knowing what the Lord's thinking while we're going through the testing. Because the lie of the devil comes and lies to us and tells us the Lord's not thinking anything. Matter of fact, the Lord forgot us. You know, we're on the back burner and he got busy in the kitchen and we're boiling over. Lord, Lord, turn around quick. I'm on fire. You know, it's not working. Sorry, Mike, I forgot I had you on the burner back there. No, that's not what's happening. He's not forgotten us, and that's the temptation that we feel, that he has overlooked us, forgotten us, that what we're going through is for nothing, because we can't make sense of any progress while in the testing itself. And that's the power of a testing from the enemy's point of view, I mean, to really accuse us. We can't make any sense of the testing when we're in it. But chapter 6 pulls the veil back, and we see what's in his heart, what he's thinking, and what he's feeling when we're feeling nothing or when we're feeling terrible. And sometimes we feel really bad. I mean, the pain of a testing, but a lot of times the testing is simply we feel nothing. And that's part of the testing. But we find out that he feels a whole lot when we powerful desire. He's deeply engaged with us. He's watching us carefully, closely. He's moved by the way we're responding to him when we respond to him in love and in faith. We feel like nothing's happening and he's not paying attention, or we feel terrible pain or anguish because he thinks he's totally forgotten us and we're all by ourselves and the trial's not making any sense and it's not producing any fruit in our life. And beloved, I got good news for you. That's a total lie. That whatever we're going through, his eyes are on us. And his book is recording our heart responses to him. And I don't mean the negative ones. I'm talking about, Lord, I love you. Lord, I want to obey you. Lord, I can't make sense of what's going on, but I do love you. Those responses he's recording in his book. And they move him, and they matter, and they actually change us. So we'll look for a moment at chapter 5, just a quick review, her testing. Then we'll look at chapter 6, what he's feeling while she's tested and how he responds to her after the testing is over. So we go back, review, Roman numeral 1, paragraph A, the bride had prayed for both the north winds of adversity and the south winds of blessing or refreshing. Now we understand praying for the south winds, Lord bless me. But she wasn't asking for trouble. That's not what she's asking for, really. She was saying, Lord, I so trust your leadership that if a time of testing comes, I trust you. And sometimes it's the devil knocking on our door, and we need to rebuke the devil and tell him to go away. But sometimes the pain of the testing is not knowing what God's feeling or not seeing his hand or not making sense of it. And that's the adversity of the north wind often. It says here in Song of Solomon chapter 4, verse 16, she says, "Awake, O north wind, and blow, O south wind, upon the garden of my heart, that those fragrances would flow out of my heart." And spiritually speaking, that's the presence of God and virtue and character that's moving to the Lord's heart, and love being growing in our heart and being manifest from us. Then she says, "Let my beloved come to his garden and eat its pleasant fruits. Because the first four chapters, if you remember, of this eight-chapter love song, it's all about her life and her garden being hers. She loved Jesus, but mostly for how Jesus would bless her and provide for her, and we always honor that. I mean, a billion years from now, we'll be completely awestruck by what he gives us and what we receive from him. We'll never, ever outgrow that. Forever, we'll be singing, "Worthy is the Lamb," for what he did for us. It's we'll never, ever outgrow our gratitude. But what she comes to understand, that Jesus is not just a means to her end of spiritual blessing, but Jesus is actually the end. He's the goal. He's the end product. That not only do we have an inheritance in him, but he actually has an inheritance in us. There's something he's waiting for from us, not just something we're receiving from him. So she, right here, she says, "Lord, let the north and the south wind blow. I'm not going to draw back like she did in chapter 2. I'm not going to yield to fear. I'm going to trust your leadership. I'm going to take the risky steps of faith, and I will endure the times when I can't understand, and I will trust your leadership. Because my garden is now your garden. The garden of my heart is now yours. I understand it's yours. I belong to you, not just you belong to me." Both of them are true. And it's a glorious hour in our life when the revelation comes to us, not just that he belongs to us. That's a glorious hour. But another one is when we understand we belong to him for real, forever. And it moves his heart when we respond to him in that way. Paragraph B. Now this is the testing. The Lord comes to her in chapter 5. He comes, I call this, he's coming as the Jesus of Gethsemane. She knew the Jesus who sat at the table in chapter 1 and chapter 2. He fed her under the shade tree and refreshed her. She knew the Jesus who was leaping on mountains. She knew the Jesus on his wedding chariot in the palanquin in chapter 3. She knew the Jesus whose heart was ravished for her in chapter 4. But now, the Jesus of Gethsemane. He comes and he says, verse 2, "It's the voice of my beloved." She's speaking. And telling the story, he knocked and he said, "Open for me." She goes, "Okay, I mean, you're the one I love. I just asked you to send the north winds and the south winds. Of course, whatever you want, I'll open for you." He says, "For my head is covered with the dew of the night. My hair or my locks with the drops of the night." So we have him in the dark night the phrase we used last week was the dark night of the soul in terms of the believer. But here he is in the dark night alone in the Garden of Gethsemane is the picture from the New Testament point of view. And he's saying, "I'm here in the darkness of the night. The dew of the morning is on my head. And I want you to come join me in this dimension of who I am. I want you to touch it." Not that we earn or contribute anything to our salvation. That's not what we're talking about. But as we looked at in our last session, Paul called it the fellowship of his sufferings, the fellowship together with him in his sufferings. Paragraph C, back in chapter 5, she responded in obedience. She didn't draw back like she did in chapter 2, but she responded in obedience. She said, "Yes, I will come to you as the Jesus of Gethsemane," using the New Testament application of it or the spiritual interpretation. And he says, "Okay, if you're going to know this, then the next two things that happen is that he allows a twofold test to test her love, to test her faith. And then what happens is that he withdraws his presence from her. Now we know from our last session and just the biblical Bible knowledge, he never withdraws his presence in the full sense of the word. But we're talking about that discernible sense where she's feeling it and she's enjoying the sense of his presence. And now she says here in verse 6, I opened for my beloved. I responded to him. I rose up from my bed, but my beloved had turned away. He was gone. I sought for him, and I couldn't find him. She says, I don't know what's happening. It's not like it was just a month ago. Something's different. It was so fresh. It was so alive. It felt so strong, and now it feels silent. It feels cold. It feels distant. Now, it isn't. The Lord's just standing back, and he's saying, are you in this relationship just for you, or are you in it for me? Will you love me no matter what? Do you only love me when things go well and you feel what you want to feel in my presence? Is it the feeling you're after, or is it love that you're after with me? Because if you love me, you can love me whether you feel it or whether the circumstances are working or not. And if you're only after the feelings, I'm going to cause this situation to draw your love to a new level. I'm going to give you an opportunity to work that faith muscle, to work the faith muscle where we're having confidence in his leadership and confidence in his love. Well, the second test in verse 7, the watchman struck me and they wounded me and they took my veil away from me. So now she loses her ministry. The leaders in the spiritual community, the watchmen, they strike her and they take her covering away. So she not only in verse 6 loses the sense of his presence, she loses verse 7 the sense of her ministry and her function. So everything she wanted is going bad. But look how she answers in verse 8. She goes, oh, daughters of Jerusalem, if you find my beloved, tell him this, I'm not offended at all. I'm not having second thoughts. I'm lovesick. Tell him I love him even when it's going like this. I am really in it for him. Yes, I love his blessing and I want his blessing, but when I can't see the things I saw in previous seasons, I'm going to stay steady because I actually love him no matter what. I mean, what an amazing work of grace in a believer's heart when they come to this conclusion. Then she went on and said, the daughters of Jerusalem said, how can you love him so much the way he's treating you? And she said, my beloved is wide. He's radiant. My beloved is dazzling. One translation says he's chief among 10,000. He's altogether lovely. I'm not offended. I'm not having second guesses. I'm not drawing back. He is lovely to me. He's chief among 10,000. He's infinite in his superiority above all the other beloveds. I am lovesick. He's radiant. That's how I view him. And the daughters are really taken back by this extravagant response of love in such a time of difficulty. Paragraph D, back in chapter 5, and we'll end the review with this. The daughters asked two questions. When they saw her with the presence of God lifted from her, His presence never leaves us ever. But again, those discernible feelings that we can get accustomed to, that in some seasons we don't have them like we had them in a previous season. So they had seen her in that condition. She was mistreated by the watchmen, the leaders of the church. Well, in the terms of the spiritual interpretation, they mistreated her. They took her ministry away. It wrongly accused her. Things were going bad. And they ask her a question in chapter 5, verse 9. Well, they ask her two, but the first one they said, what is your beloved more than any other beloved? In other words, why do you love him so much more than all the others? We have other beloveds in our life that we love more than him, the king. But you love the king more than all the other beloveds. There is no other that you love more than him. It's not even your spiritual tranquility. It's not your increase of ministry. It's not any human relationship. You love him as your chief beloved above all the others. And then after she went through, after this test, and they go, how can you love him? Why do you love him? And she goes, oh, he's chief among 10,000. He's altogether lovely. And she gives this tremendous description of his glory and his beauty that we looked at in the last session. So here in paragraph E, now after they hear this remarkable description of how glorious her beloved was and how good and altogether lovely, they said, wow, they changed their question. Because their first question was, why do you love him so much in paragraph D? But now in paragraph E, in chapter 6, verse 1, they're saying, How could we know him like you? Instead of why do you love him, we want what you have. They said, where is your beloved? Not why do you love him, where is he? We want to seek him like you seek him. We want what you have. And so then, now we're going to chapter 6. Now the king breaks the silence because he had been completely silent. He had let the elders, the watchmen of the city, the leaders mistreat her, neglect her. She lost her position. He had watched her not having the same kind of feelings and the sense of favor and the circumstances, but he had been quiet all the time, and he was carefully watching, earnestly watching, having deep feelings every step of the way. Though she could feel nothing, he could feel so much. I mean, she couldn't feel anything positive in the sense of by what was happening in the circumstances. In chapter 6, verse 4 to 10, the king broke the silence that began back in chapter 5, verse 6. The king breaks the silence, and he tells her how he felt about her each step of the way during her testing. And he wants her to know how she moved his heart. This is one of the great statements in the Song of Solomon. I think of the whole Bible, this is one of those, you know, 100 of the top. You know, when you talk of the whole Bible, you can have 100 favored ones. There you go. But here in chapter 6, verse 4, he breaks the silence, and he says, oh, my love, you are as beautiful as Tirzah. You are as lovely as Jerusalem. You are as awesome as an army with banners. Then he says this very emotional, dramatic statement. Verse 5, turn your eyes from me, your eyes of devotion, your eyes of love, for your eyes have overcome me. I mean, this is not a statement of literally, would you please turn around and leave the room? That's not what he's saying. He's talking poetically. He goes, I am overcome by the such devotion you have when what you were experiencing was so difficult. It was so hard. It was everything opposite of what you wanted, but you never backed away from me. You're really in it for me, not just in it for me to help you. Now, beloved, we always want him helping us to the fullness. I'm in no way minimizing that. And in other chapters of the book, in the first four chapters, that point is made over and over and over. And again, forever, we will want everything that he will give us, and we will be fully grateful and never minimize it. So I'm not comparing the two. I'm putting the two together. I'm not comparing one versus the other. I'm saying that the two together is the relationship he's after, where we receive from him an inheritance and he receives from us an inheritance called our love. Well, he starts off and he says, oh, my love, you are as beautiful as Tirzah. And by the way, on the website, I have additional notes, so I got a bit more on all of this, so you can check that out later if you want to. But I just wanted to make the notes a little shorter for the class. And so almost every session, I have a longer session on the website with a bit more detail on it. He says, you are as beautiful as Tirzah. Now, Tirzah was one of the most attractive cities in the northern, it was one of the most attractive cities in the ancient world at that time. But it was the capital city up in the north, because there was a civil war after King Solomon, and there was the southern kingdom, where Jerusalem was the capital city, and then there was the northern kingdom, and there for some years they had a war going back and forth that lasted quite a long time. And at times they had peace, and times they had animosity. And Tirzah was such a beautiful city that after Solomon's day, because Solomon's alive writing this poem at this time, it was such a beautiful city. It was a Canaanite city before Joshua conquered the land with the children of Israel. And it was a capital city, but then after Solomon's day, they made it a capital city again after the split and the civil war took place in 933 B.C. No, I'm going through the math. Solomon was 970, 930. Yeah, I think it's 933 B.C. is when the civil war was. Anyway, I didn't need to do that. But when I quote a date, it's better to have it in my brain instead of do it on the flight. Okay, so some see Tirzah as a city symbolic of the unbelieving Gentiles, because it was a Gentile, beautiful Canaanite city before Solomon's day. And so the bride, see this, and I like this interpretation, the spiritual interpretation of it. And it could mean a number of things, and as long as it's a New Testament truth, that's what really matters, is that we take the symbolism of this to honor a truth that is strongly found in the New Testament. But the bride is beautiful also to unbelievers, and that's why believers that are walking in the Spirit are so effective in evangelism, winning them, because they see the bride's sacrificial love for the king. And they see her as somebody who gave up everything for love. And they see a believer like that, and they go, who is the king you love? And why do you love him? I mean, I want what you have is the response. And so in the spiritual interpretation of this, he says, you're as beautiful as Tirzah, that even the unbelievers will look in marvel and wonder to see the beauty of who I am, says the Lord, and the way that you love me, it shines forth from you when you live in this kind of devotion and this kind of dedication to me, even in a time of testing. Paragraph C, he says, top of page 2. He goes on, he says, you're as lovely as Jerusalem. Now, Tirzah was the capital city, the pagan capital city in the north before Solomon's day. And then it became a capital city after Solomon's day as well, after the division of the tribes of Israel. But Jerusalem was the southern capital. Now, Jerusalem is the only city that was chosen by God to put his temple in. He put his temple in the city of Jerusalem. And of course, Jesus called the city of Jerusalem his city in Matthew chapter 5, I think verse 35, where Jesus said that he called it the city of the great king in Matthew chapter 5. And so it's his city, because not only was the temple built in that city, but Jesus' throne will be in that city forever. It is the city of the great king. It's the only place on earth that God's presence was continually manifest, that was blessed with the continual manifest presence of God, the manifest presence of the Lord. Because of Solomon's temple being there, the Shekinah of glory was in that temple, and the manifest presence was in the city, in the temple, in the Holy of Holies, continually. And so that city spoke of the presence of God. That city will be in the millennial kingdom the worship center for the whole earth. That city speaks of the beauty of holiness found in worshiping God. I mean, Jerusalem is all about the temple and the throne of Jesus, the presence of God, the beauty of holiness. That's what Jerusalem represents poetically in this love song, or anybody who understands the destiny of Jerusalem, you know that it's beauty, it's worship, it's presence, it's the throne, it's the king city, it's everything that's beautiful spiritually. And so he's saying to her, you're as beautiful as Tirzah. You have a love that even can be seen by the unbelievers that will move them. You're as beautiful as Jerusalem. I mean, you are a picture of what the beauty of holiness, worshiping God, looks like, because you're enthralled with the king, because you're so given to the king. Paragraph D. Well, the king went on and added a third description. He says, you are as awesome as an army with banners. Now, an army with banners was an army that returned from the battle victorious. That when the army came back to the main city, to the capital city, after it had a great victory, they had a military parade. And in the military parade, they would show all the banners, they would raise them up. So an army marching with the banners meant they came home victorious in the battle, and the whole country has gathered in the capital city, and they're all celebrating the great victory. So what he's saying to her in the spiritual interpretation, that she defeated her greatest enemies, and her greatest enemies were those in her own heart, I mean, the people rise up and attack us. The enemy comes and strikes us. But as I've liked to say, I've said it many times, I, I love this little concept that when we think of Solomon's father, King David, that David had Saul, King Saul, angry, jealous King Saul, pursuing him with 3,000 men to kill him. I mean, 3,000 men were pursuing one man, David, to kill him. But beloved, the armies of Saul can't stop David. The demons in hell can't stop David. Nobody can stop David except for David. The only one that can stop David is David. And when David came to understand that, he had a boldness in his relationship with the Lord. Somebody can interrupt and cause a hesitation and a frustration in the will of God unfolding in your life for a brief moment. But whatever your calling is, whatever your ministry is, whatever your sphere, whatever God's ordained for you, the devil can't stop it if you're in agreement with God. The enemy's rising up against you, you know, saying this about you and accusing you that. They can't stop the will of God. The only person that can stop the will of God in my life is me. And the only one that can stop it in your life is you. I mean, stop it long term in a permanent sense. And that's by breaking our agreement with the Lord and just giving our way to compromise or to that spirit of unbelief and fear and complaint and offense where we draw back and we say, I don't trust you like I used to. And that's what can stop our ministries and our destiny and the purpose of God in our life. So what he's saying to her is that you've defeated the greatest enemy, those in your own heart. Look at you. You lost your ministry. You lost the sense of my presence, but you didn't lose your devotion to me. You didn't lose your confidence in me. You didn't lose your love for me. You didn't lose your vision of the relationship you would have with me. You didn't lose any of it. Look at you. And she was steady. She goes, I'm lovesick. My beloved is dazzling. He's radiant. His head, his leadership is like finest gold. He's altogether lovely. This is my beloved. This is my friend. And she went on and said much more than that. She was like a victorious army with banners because she didn't give in to sin. She didn't give in to unbelief. And giving in to sin and unbelief, I don't mean stumbling. We can stumble and we fall and we say, wait a second. This isn't my destiny. This isn't who I am. No, I'm not camping out here. I'm not camping out here. Scripture says a righteous man falls 7 times, gets up. So it's not the stumble. That's not what we're talking about. It's the staying down that is the defeat. I mean, we don't want to stumble. I'm not minimizing stumbling. But it's that posture of we get into that cynical attitude towards the Lord, that spirit of bitterness that we don't even know we have, where we're saying, Jesus, I don't really trust your leadership anymore. Not really. And I don't know that we really say that to God. I mean, he's so powerful. And we think, well, I think I'm just going to hesitate for now. But what we're really saying sometimes, I don't trust you anymore. That's what I mean, camping out and letting that attitude set up and become the new way of our life. Because the stumble, though I'm not minimizing the stumble is not the fall. Meaning when Jesus looked at Peter on the night when Jesus was betrayed, he said, Peter, you're going to stumble. But he said, when you recover, I want you to strengthen all your brothers. And he really did stumble, but he recovered and was a great, had a great ministry. The chief apostle on the day of Pentecost, et cetera. So the Lord sees our stumble. The stumble is I take seriously, but it's the camping out in the stumble that constitutes a fall. And that's what she didn't give into. She didn't give into that attitude. She didn't let that set up in her heart. Paragraph E. Then he says, turn your eyes away from me. Because your eyes of love, is the idea, have overwhelmed me. And again, he's not literally telling her to look away, to go in the other room or something. He's poetically describing the impact of her love on him. Beloved, when we feel nothing in a time of testing, we don't feel his presence, we can't make sense of what's happening, we don't see an answer, we don't see a hope on the horizon, except for we believe him and we believe who he is. He is deeply touched. When we look to him with eyes of love, In this next sentence at the end of paragraph E, I just want you to put a little asterisk by it if you want to, because I want you to think on this a little bit. It's very, very simple but practical application of what it means to look upon him with love. Loving Jesus includes cultivating an ongoing conversation with him. In other words, not drawing back in offense and saying, I'm not talking anymore to you. You know what? I'm going to get busy with other things. I'm going to get preoccupied with something else. It's cultivating an ongoing conversation. In other words, we stay preoccupied with him is the point of the ongoing conversation. But it's a conversation in which we express affection in the conversation. And we express with affection our gratitude. We thank him. Beloved, I don't care how bad the test is we're going through or the setback. We have a great deal. He has given us a great deal. The devil comes and tells us we're getting a bad deal, that God's not treating us right. Beloved, we're talking about the uncreated God became human because he wanted you. He came to the earth. He's going to be human forever, by the way. When he became human, he didn't cast off his humanity after the resurrection. He has to be human forever because he wants you. He came down, bore the wrath of God, rose from the dead, ascended to the right hand of the Father, freely forgave us, gave us his righteousness, gave us the indwelling spirit. We'll have a resurrected body. We'll live for billions of years in the new Jerusalem on a new earth in a resurrected body in the presence of the King as his bride forever, in love with him, loving one another. Beloved, we have it made. We really have it made. And in the 40 years I've walked with the Lord, I have blown it so many times, I deserve not to have that. But he goes, no, I want you to have it. Like, if you're going to give me what I deserve to be set aside, not have be heir of all of these glorious things. Beloved, don't let the devil lie to you thinking you're getting a bad deal because the money's not coming through, your ministry's not growing, someone broke your heart, or you have a sickness in your body. I don't minimize that. But it's like, well, where's God? You know, I'm sick. Well, I love healing, and I love walking in healing and health. But beloved, we're going to be in the resurrection for billions and billions of years. So I don't look at him and say, how dare you? Where are you? Because where am I? I got scars in my hands because I want you so desperately. That's where I'm at. And you're going to be with me forever. I'm with you right now. And then, you know, I've seen over the years, you know, moments of times where I think, oh, Lord, where are you? And there's right around the corner, the breakthrough comes. I'm like, oh, gee whiz, why did I do all that talking about? And then the breakthrough comes. He goes, there I am, and I gave you more besides. Well, it's an ongoing conversation with affection. I mean, that we express our with affection, we express gratitude, number one. Number two, we express our intent to obey. And number three, we express our trust in his leadership. All three of those are different. Expressing our gratitude, expressing our intention to obey him. I will obey you as an expression of my love, and I trust your leadership. Trusting his leadership moves his heart. And all three of those, gratitude, obedience, and trust, are components of the gaze of love, the look of love. It's not just obedience. It's obedience with trust. It's not just trust. It's gratitude. It's gratitude with obedience. And it's all three of those with I love you, affection all the way through it. I'm not just grateful. I love you, but thank you too. That's how she was looking at him through this very difficult time. What overcomes his heart? Well, the greatness of the stars. I mean, I look up at the stars and I go, wow. He doesn't say wow. The mighty oceans, the mountains, the armies of man cannot conquer him. The armies of hell can't conquer him. The only thing that can conquer him is the eyes of his bride who loves him and trusts him even in times of difficulty. That's what moves him. I mean, that's the only thing that touches him in the way that even poetically could be called, you overcame me. And again, that's poetic language. He's conquered by our love. He's crowned by our love in that other poetic way that we get from Song of Solomon chapter 3, verse 11. I mean, when we trust him, when we obey him, when we want to go the other direction, when we have gratitude, when things aren't working, it moves him deeply. Paragraph G, do you know the way that you move him? I mean, oh, the marvel of moving God's heart. I mean, the marvel of that. Look at Psalm 56. David wrote this. Verse 8. He said, God, you number my wanderings. The wanderings is not good. David was in Ziklag at the time. He was wandering. He had some compromise in his life. He goes, you know my wanderings. He goes, I know that you know my struggles. Instead of wanderings, don't think of it getting, you know, lost in the neighborhood in a new city. No, that's not what it's talking about. He's talking about struggles and tripping and some compromise. He goes, you know my wanderings. And you've seen my tears of love that I don't like what I'm stumbling in. And you don't say, oh, just deal with it and quit sinning. You see my tears. You don't write me off. Matter of fact, you put my tears in your bottle. And not only do you put them in a bottle, you write them in the book. It's like the tears coming down of failure, the tears of confusion. But I love you, Jesus. And I'm not backing away and I don't understand it. But I love you. And the tears are coming. And it's like the picture is like the angel swoops down there and captures that tear in God's bottle. That's how David's talking in this poetic sense. I mean, an angel doesn't really come with a bottle. That's not the point. But they are really written in his book. And the book that what he writes in the book is, I saw the way that you reached to love me when you were wandering and struggling. And no, I did not write you off. No, I did not cast you off. I did not do that. I was moved by your tears. I didn't call you hopeless hypocrite. I said, I love the way you love me. Come on, come near me. And David said, my tears, you treasured them. You captured them in your bottle. You wrote the story in your book because it's that dear to you. Beloved, that's the way you move him. The devil is a liar. I just wanted to say that. He lies to us constantly. He's a liar. Okay, Roman number 3. Then you can read this and a little bit more on the additional notes if you want. But now he describes her. Remember, it's this agricultural setting of the ancient world, and she lives in an agricultural community, the Shulamite maiden, the bride. So he's talking to her in language that, of course, was familiar to the whole world in that day. The whole world was living in an agricultural society. So he talks to her in three different, he highlights three aspects of her character, her hair, her teeth, and her temples. And in this, he's talking about virtues in the spiritual application. Paragraph B, when he talks about her hair, you can read this more on your own. That speaks of her dedication to God. But because the hair of the Nazirite vow was the outward sign of their dedication. And there's more besides that. There's more on why hair would mean that, but that's just a quick statement. More are on the notes. And then we covered the hair earlier back in chapter 4 as well. Her teeth would speak of her ability to chew the solid food of the word, to receive the meat of the word. Her ability to take the word of God and receive it. Receive the meat of the word. Infants have no teeth. They can only be nourished on milk. It's like, that's what Paul the Apostle talked about, the milk of the word. The temples, it's the same word in Hebrew that's often translated the cheeks. So whether it's the temples or the cheeks, that speaks of her emotions. And our cheeks express our emotions, whether anger or sadness or gladness. Our cheeks are our windows into what's happening into our emotions. And he gives her these statements in agricultural language that validate in the new, again, in the spiritual interpretation, her character. Your dedication moves me. The way that you live by the word moves me. The way that your heart has resisted the accusations and the temptation to be offended, and you stay true to me and you come after me, your emotions. Now, guys, read chapter 6, verse 5 here. Your hair's like a flock of goats. Don't try that. Don't tell her teeth are like a flock of goats. If she didn't grow up on the farm, that's not going to move her. And if she did grow on the farm, it's not going to move her. Okay, top of page 3. I just thought I'd just throw that out there just for fun. Okay, just in the last 2 or 3 minutes here, I'm just going to just kind of speed through this because you have the notes here. In chapter 6, verse 8 and 9, he's not only, because he just said in verse 5, that your heart moved me. My heart was moved by you. And then the last couple of verses we looked at, your dedication moves me. The way that you lean on the word, receive the word, the way that you resist the negative emotions and stay steady to believe me, that moves me. Now here, paragraph A, he's revealing to her her place in his heavenly court. And he says in verse 8, now this is King Solomon in his earthly court. He says, I have 60 queens. At that time, he had 60 queens. He had more before it was over. He had 80 concubines, which actually a concubine was a legally part of the king's family in the harem. And I had virgins without numbers. They were like, you know, the maids in waiting, you've seen in through history and royal courts. And they were servants, but not a part of the family. So what he's doing in paragraph B is that as a king's court had included his harem comprised of women with various ranks, in this poem, King Solomon's earthly royal court symbolizes Jesus' heavenly court, is the idea. In his heavenly court, it's not 60 queens and 80 concubines, but it's seraphim and cherubim and mighty angels and archangels and 24 elders. There's all of these ranks in the courts of heaven. What this passage is saying, Jesus is saying that my bride has more honor than all the angelic ranks gathered around me. I only have one bride, though I have a multitude of dignified ones in my royal court around my throne, but you are the only one. He's talking now, obviously, to the whole corporate bride as one voice. You are the one I want. You're the one that is mine forever. So look at Roman numeral 5. Then in verse 9, it highlights the bride's unique favor, her unique stature. And he says, you are my dove, my perfect one. You're the only one. And the word only is translated by some Bibles as you're the unique one. In other words, compared to the seraphim, the cherubim, the archangels, all the ranks of the angelic, there's only one unique one that is my eternal companion. There's only one that I've allowed to be a part of my family. Again, it's the corporate bride. I mean, it's you know, a billion or 2 billion, hopefully more, believers through history, counting the great end time harvest. It's the redeemed. They are mine. They rule with me forever. Paragraph C. It was the writer of Hebrews that said that God had crowned the redeemed with glory and honor. The redeemed are crowned with glory and honor because we're not just connected to his heart, we're exalted with him. Beloved, we have an exaltation and we have a nearness to his heart forever that the angels will never have, the archangels will never have. I mean, the greatest archangels and the seraphim don't have the relationship with God that the redeemed have. They are attendants with glory and honor. But beloved, you have more glory and honor in God's court. You're part of his family forever. Top of page 4. Then goes on and we'll end this here in verse 10. The bride is a co-heir in the kingdom. And now he's going to describe her by four heavenly objects. In verse 4 and 5, he described her by earthly cities. Earthly objects, now he's going to describe her by four heavenly objects. He says, not only do you move me, do you have a high place of honor in my kingdom, look at where your destiny is. Look at how I'm going to use you. Look at the way the glory will be manifest with you. Who is she who shines forth as the morning? Who is she that is beautiful as the moon? Who is she that is as bright as the sun? I added different words in. Because other translations have those words. Shining as the morning, bright as the sun, as beautiful as the moon. These four metaphors were used to express her beauty by comparing her to heavenly objects. So this time when it's an army with banners, the context of verse 10 is the heavenly and the eternal realm, not the earthly back in chapter 4 and verse 5, because the whole context of verse 10 is the heavenly dimension of her beauty and her destiny with him. Paragraph C, she shines forth as the morning. Go down a few sentences. This speaks of the church in this age functioning as salt and light. Because the morning, the dawning of the morning brings the light while the residue of the night darkness is still there. And so the body of Christ, we're partnering with Jesus even now as salt and light in the time when the light is still shining, the light of God through his people, but there's still the residue of the morning darkness that the light is shining in context to. It says in paragraph D, you are as beautiful, as fair as the moon. Well, in Genesis 1, the moon was established by God to provide light in the nighttime. It says in Genesis 1 that he created the sun for the day, but he created the moon to rule the night. And again, he's talking about you have this supernatural dimension of my grace shining through you. It's supernatural. It's a heavenly reality, supernatural dimension of grace where you can actually say words and demons are moved and unbelief is overcome in the hearts of unbelievers and the goodness of God is released by your words. You are like, you have the beauty of the moon. Now, the way that the moon works is the moon is merely a reflection of the sun. The moon has no light of its own. The moon only shines because it reflects the sun. Then it goes in paragraph E, talks about you're as bright as the sun. This is talking about the fullness of light. This is in the age to come. We're not going to always just be shining light in the context of darkness, but there's the day, the full day is coming. The fullness of light is coming. And beloved, the church will reflect the light of Jesus even in the New Jerusalem. I mean, when you read the passages here in Revelation 21, the city of God and the people of God are so filled with the light of God that though Jesus is the light, also the bride and the city are just radiant with his light forever and forever. The brightness and the beauty of the sun, poetically speaking, that is your destiny, not just to shine light in this age, but to be light bearers forever, connected with him in glory forever and forever. He goes, that's what I looked at you and saw when you were in that dark night, wondering if I was real, wondering where I was, and when you were being tested, I was thinking these things about you, how you move me and what your destiny is and how beautiful you are to me. So, beloved, when you're in that dark night of testing, go to chapter 6, and this is what he thinks about you when you can't feel anything. Amen and amen. Let's stand. Well, I spent too much time on the first part. I so love that you've overcome my heart. I just camped there too long that I didn't get to